Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Dudley Square in Roxbury has a new name, Nubian Square.
I think it's a proud moment for our glorious past, for our struggle in the present, and our phenomenal future that we envision.
Also today,
Article 1 is adopted.
Legal analysis of yesterday's historic vote to impeach the president. Where do we go from here? And a look at the changes and defining moments of religion in America over the past decade. Vice President Pence says the trend is upward.
Religion in America isn't receding. It's just the opposite. Faith is gaining new life across America every day.
Do you agree? We'll take your calls. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Dudley Square in Roxbury has a new name, Nubian Square. Dudley Square was a nod to Thomas Dudley, a four-term governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, who was accused of having enabled slave trading. The new name is intended to honor the majority black population that calls the square home. So here to tell us more about the name change is WBUR's own Cristela Guerra. Hello, Cristela.
Hi, Tiziana. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you. This is so interesting because this comes after a citywide referendum in which actually 54% of the people voted against the name change. So how did we get here?
So, yeah, in November, this was on the ballot. And though most people in Boston voted no, the majority of Roxbury voted yes, which led the mayor to support petitioning the Public Improvement Commission, who held today's hearing, and they approved the name change.
So why Nubian Square? I mean, obviously, there must have been some process to propose a name other than Dudley Square. How did we wind up at Nubian Square?
So it's kind of a six-year process. The rename honors two things: a local community store, a Nubian notion, which was in Dudley Square for 50 years, and the legacy of the Nubian Empire, which was one of Africa's earliest civilizations, and it's situated in modern-day Sudan.
All right. So have you spoken with anybody about the name change?
There were so many residents there today. They were so emotional and excited. Here's Marie Furman. She's a lifelong Roxbury resident, born and raised, an entrepreneur, and she talked about what this could mean for the community.
Changing the name to Nubian Square is one of the greatest things I believe this city can do, because we don't own those businesses that I saw when I was a little girl like we used to, and we need to get back to that.
And here's Siddiqui Cambone with the Nubian Square Coalition, which has pushed for the name change since 2014.
It's a name that reflects, number one, who we are as a people, making it very clear that it's not acceptable to have a name in place of someone who, in fact, was responsible for the brutalization of our ancestors and honoring them.
So there's a resident, there's somebody who helped organize for the coalition to change the name. What about those business owners? You know, the resident said, we don't own the same businesses we used to. You talked about the original business. Anybody from a local business association or somebody associated with the original business, the Nubian notion, that you had a chance to talk to?
So I didn't actually speak to them, but they were definitely there. And they were in the room, and they were absolutely in support.
So I find myself thinking about how complicated this issue was over the last couple of years as we had the discussion about it. Even in preparing for the story today, looking at Thomas Dudley's history, there's a lot of claims and counterclaims. One, that he signed a legal code in 1641 that activists say sanctioned slavery in Massachusetts. Other activists saying, no, actually, that restricted slavery. Mm-hmm. Some saying he owned slaves. Others and historians saying there's no evidence that he owned slaves. Can you tease this out for us?
It's complicated. That's a good word for it. So when Dudley signed this into law, slavery already existed in the colony. There's been disagreement about whether Dudley actually owned slaves. Some activists say he did, but Byron Rushing, who's president of the Roxbury Historical Society and a former state rep, told the Boston Globe he found no evidence that Dudley had slaves himself. The Bay State Banner pointed out in an article that the Nubian Empire also had slaves. So it's sort of an example of reckoning with history at the very local level. And in some ways, you don't want erasure, you want context. So I think that they're trying to add context to what Dudley Square originally was based in. I think Anubian Notion was the first among the first Afrocentric stores in the city of Boston. They sold African and African American inspired gifts and cards, and they sold music, and it was the communal space for such a long time. People want to honor that.
So there have been other pushes in Boston to change names. I think obviously one of the things that comes to mind for people, Yawkey Way, right outside of Fenway Park, which was named after a longtime Red Sox owner who was accused of pretty serious racism.
Absolutely.
That was changed to Jersey Street. There was a push about changing the name of Faneuil Hall. That name remains in place. Do you think that this victory signals that there are more name changes and more activism around this issue to come?
Siddiqui does. He has his eye on the station, at the MBTA station specifically. He wants that Nubian Square and Nubian Station.
And it's not automatic that the station's name changes?
No. That's a whole other policy that specifically is dealt with by the MBTA. They have an actual sort of a gathering. There's a policy in place, and then there's a committee that recommends it. So it's a whole other process.
So there's a whole next round of this to go to get the next name change in
Absolutely.
Place.
Absolutely.
All right. That's WBUR reporter Cristela Guerra. Thank you for doing this for us today. I appreciate you joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Okay. Stay with us, because coming up, we are going to look at yesterday's historic vote to impeach the President of the United States. I'm Tisiana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering.
On this vote, the yeas are 230. The nays are 197. Present is one. Article 1 is adopted.
That was House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announcing yesterday that the House of Representatives had officially impeached President Donald J. Trump, just the third time a sitting U.S. president has been impeached in our nation's history. For more, we're joined by WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins, who's in the nation's capital. Kimberly, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tisiana.
So this is, I mean, it almost seems silly to say historic. That doesn't seem big enough a word. It seems important for our country to know what it felt like there yesterday. Kimberly, can you put us in the room?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because leading up to yesterday on Capitol Hill around Washington, it sort of felt like business as usual. The gravity of the moment hadn't really hit. Certainly by last night, it had. I mean, I think it began with Congressman Steny Hoyer's closing argument for Democrats that he made that talked about the history and the solemnity of what was happening. And, you know, several lawmakers, when they were casting their votes and after they cast their votes, were emotional about what they were doing. It definitely felt heavy on them as they did this. A few people tried to applaud after Nancy Pelosi gaveled, and she admonished them with a gesture to get them to stop. But for the most part, it was a very solemn event.
Here she is talking about sort of the dichotomy of the moment.
December 18th, a great day for the Constitution of the United States, a sad one for America.
There's been a lot of talk today about sort of the way she used both her eyes and her hand to keep people from celebrating in the moment inappropriately. Today, do people seem to be reflecting that dichotomy, or is it just heaviness today?
There is some heaviness. I talked to a few lawmakers on the Capitol this morning. That heaviness, the solemnity, is still on them. You know, some of them privately, some Democrats expressed to me real disappointment and more about the way Republicans acted and the things that they said yesterday. One said actually it was disgusting. He described it because of the solemnity of this. I don't think the importance of this is lost on anyone.
So I want to juxtapose two people's comments from yesterday, kind of to highlight the fact that, it, to me as a listener, Kimberly, it felt like no one was speaking to anyone else in the room. So first we have Georgia Representative Barry Loudermilk, and the second is Massachusetts Representative Joe Kennedy, who is addressing his children. Here we go.
When Jesus was falsely accused of treason, Pontius Pilate gave Jesus the opportunity to face his accusers. During that sham trial, Pontius Pilate afforded more rights to Jesus than the Democrats have afforded this president in this process.
Dear Ellie and James, this is a moment that you will read about in your history books. Today, I will vote to impeach the President of the United States.
Kimberly, what did you make of the rhetoric in the room yesterday, and who do you think it was for?
Yeah, I think the Republicans were they had their audience, which was the President of the United States and his supporters, who in many cases they share those supporters in saying what they wanted them to hear. For Democrats, they were trying to make the case for their supporters and people who believe that the president should be impeached. The divide in Congress, if you look at polls, is reflected to the real divide in America on this issue of impeachment. So I think each side was addressing the other folks who were on their side.
You know, there's this new question that seems to be emerging today. I suppose if you'd been paying super close attention over the last couple of weeks, you knew it was out there. But people have turned their attention to the question of if and when Speaker Pelosi sends the impeachment to the Senate. Some have said she should wait until Mitch McConnell gives them the rules they want. If she waits, or I guess supposedly if she doesn't, but mostly if she waits, is there a risk of losing public support for the impeachment in that delay?
Yeah, there's not only a risk of losing public support, there's a risk of undermining the Democrats' main argument in moving forward on impeachment, which is that the president's actions are urgent, they're ongoing, and it presents a real threat right now. And I asked Congressman Joe Kennedy about that this morning, about that risk, and this is what he said.
Look, I guess there's some risk to anything. I think there's also a risk to sending these articles over immediately, understanding that the Senate Majority Leader has violated the oath that he will take as a juror in this case, to be an impartial juror, who has said literally that he is not one.
And he's referring to the fact that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell called himself in. He said he was not an impartial juror, and he has declined Democrats' requests to bring witnesses at the trial.
Kimberly, you and I have talked a lot over the last few months on this show, helping listeners understand what's happening in Washington, dissecting it, explaining it. I got to tell you, I was really struck today by how sad I am, how heavy my heart feels. How do we heal after this as a country? How do we put the pieces back together, regardless of how any one individual may feel about the decision that was taken last night?
You know, I'm not sure that anybody really knows the answer to that, but it is something that lawmakers do talk about. They talk about the division within the Congress and within the country, and they talk about what it takes to get beyond that, realizing that it's something that will probably exist when Donald Trump is no longer president, whether it is after his term ends or if he's removed. So I don't know if people know the answer to that, but it is something that people talk about here.
That is WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins. Kimberly, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
So let's turn now to another person who has guided us through understanding this process over the last few months, WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner. Judge Gertner is also a retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Welcome back again.
I'm glad to be here.
So there are so many questions that I have for you to put things in context. I think where I'd like to start, we've heard quite a bit, especially in the last couple of days, about how unprecedented decisions that the Democrats have made around process are, unprecedented the way the Republicans used their rhetoric. But this is only the third time in history, so it seems like most things are unprecedented in a moment like this. But we use precedent as a way to compare and contrast people's behavior in order to try to figure out who's acting in good faith. So how do we proceed when there really isn't a lot of precedent to use as a measuring stick?
Well, there is precedent for the procedures in the House. And so the contrast is, did the president get less fair procedures than Nixon got, than Clinton got? And my understanding is that both in terms of the timing and the procedures, which is initially a confidential, secret proceeding, much like a grand jury where both Republicans and Democrats could question witnesses, as well as the stuff on the floor, the procedures on the floor, they were identical to past impeachment proceedings. And that is to say, Clinton on the one hand and Nixon on the other. Nixon never got to a vote on impeachment. So in terms of procedure, you know, this looks to be exactly the same.
I noticed, though, that you said in the House.
In the House.
So now we're likely to go to the Senate.
Right.
What about precedent there?
Well, there really is not much except for Clinton. But the Constitution tells us next to nothing about how this should be done. It just says the Senate shall have the power to try impeachments. So the implication of try is a trial, right? And then the next sentence is, when sitting for this purpose, the senator shall be, quote, on oath or affirmation. And that suggests that they will be juror-like. And that's pretty much, and the Chief Justice shall preside. That's pretty much all it says. But it clearly conveys the implication that this is trial-like with the senator sitting as jurors and arguably impartial. That certainly collides with the fact that this is a political process. But it is a political process that has trial-like aspects.
So I want to unpack a couple of things. You've been pretty clear with us over the last few months that the impeachment procedures in the House, that is a political process. All along, as we've talked about the handoff to the Senate, it seems that we do have this expectation of a trial. If you were going to sort of balance out on a continuum, in the Senate, the expectation that it's really trial-like versus it's another political process that resembles in some ways a trial, where is it reasonable to expect that it ought to come out?
Well, it's a hard question. So Clinton really was a trial, which was the Chief Justice presiding. One side was presenting evidence. The other side was contesting it. I don't think that they had to present witnesses because, in fact, all they had to do was present the findings of the House. And then there was a vote. It's political in this sense that because you're talking about the President of the United States and the Constitution reposes his power in Congress, courts are not involved. Courts are really not involved at all. So it's political in the sense that the ultimate decision maker is the Senate. But it's trial-like because it's unlike anything else the Senate does. The Senate is acting in a different function here. That's the best I can say. But surely announcing at the outset, you know, I'm biased, is troubling. Very troubling.
So what Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said was, everything I do during this, I'm coordinating with the White House counsel. There will be no difference between the president's position and our position as to how to handle this. In the realm of a trial, how far, how does one process that if when we're thinking about this as attempting to be trial-like?
Well, let's sort of translate that, okay? So I'm trying Tiziana Dearing as my defendant. You've done something dastardly.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. And I say that all the procedures in the courtroom will be done in coordination with what you want. That's one-sided. it lacks precedent. Certainly, I might consider what you want. I might want to balance that against what the people who are prosecuting this want, but to suggest that everything we do here is going to be what one side wants suggests it's not trial-like at all.
One of the other things that has come up that feels different than a trial is this question about whether there will be evidence, new evidence or new testimony.
Right.
How, according to the, I think you just read us
I
everything
did.
The Constitution
doesn't
says.
Doesn't say much, right.
So I was going to say, you may have already answered this question because my question was, what does the Constitution say about whether or not there should or could or ought to be anything new that happens on the Senate side?
Nothing.
Nothing.
It says nothing on that. There's nothing to, but the rules of the Senate trial are determined by the Senate. And so, and that should be by a majority rule. So they could, the Senate could vote to allow witnesses. There's no reason. And if the House impeachment is like a grand jury, the presentation of allegations, and the Senate is like a trial, witnesses would not be far from what a trial would do.
Although if they didn't take witnesses, if I understand you correctly, they would also not be far from the president in the Clinton Senate process where they also did not take witnesses.
That's right. They essentially discussed the House report. So but the bottom line is that essentially the House, the Senate, a majority of the Senate could vote to change, to make this more fair rules. Mitt Romney, Susan Collins, Barbara Murkowski, they could change the rules to make it more fair.
You're naming some people who are known as more moderate Republicans.
That's right.
On the Senate
That's right.
side. All right. So the other person who seems to be bending rules, although we don't really have a lot of rules because this is only the third time in history, is Nancy Pelosi in suggesting that she's going to make her own decisions about when and how to hand this impeachment, the articles, over to the Senate. People seem very upset about that. How unusual, or again, it's hard. We don't have a lot to compare it
right,
to.
Right, that's right.
I'm just going to say weird. How weird is it to have the Speaker of the House saying, I'll get to it when I get to it, depending on what I see?
Well, I think that there is no precedent for it. The Constitution says nothing about it. Presumably the House usually doesn't have a role in what the Senate rules would be. So it's unusual in that respect. It's hard to say she has violated anything since the Constitution doesn't say anything about it.
Could she conceivably never hand them over?
She could conceivably, she could try. And then what's the recourse? That's the problem. You're now dealing with decisions that are made by the political branches as to which courts typically do not intervene, right? Imagine she says, I'm going to turn it over January 1st, and the Republicans go roaring into court. Pretend I'm the judge in that case. The likelihood, 9 times out of 10, a judge, or 10 times out of 10, a judge would say, this is a political question as to which courts have no jurisdiction. The Constitution doesn't speak to it. We don't have jurisdiction over the rules of the Senate or the rules of the House. So what she can do may be determined by what kind of redress if she doesn't do what people expect. And I can't see any redress.
So to some extent, whatever it is, it is what it is.
Good, good point.
Okay.
And what are you citing on that? Deering on it is what
right,
it is. I got it.
Right.
Okay.
Let it be known. So I guess then the last question I have, because you've said a couple of times the courts will stay out of this. This is a political process. It's trial-like, but it's not a trial. And then we have the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States overseeing it, should Pelosi ever decide to give it to the Senate and they decide on rules. So yeah, I'm going to continue to keep it simple. What's that about?
Yeah, well, the Constitution just says that the Chief Justice shall preside. Now, what that means is that he then is the enforcer of whatever rules have been passed. That if the Senate says the rules are 1 through 10, he is the enforcer of those rules and administers oaths, et cetera. That's also no different than an ordinary trial, right? I didn't get to determine the rules of evidence. They were determined by someone else. So that's really no different. And I can't imagine, knowing him, that he would intervene in any considerable degree.
All right. So last question. There's more to come. What are you watching for?
Well, I think that the pressure on Pelosi will be sooner rather than later to turn this over. Yeah. And the Senate, there are risks, I suppose, of McConnell making this look like a kangaroo court, really. There are risks. Then that becomes another asterisk on the president's, quote, exoneration here. So I mean, my hope, and this is not a prediction, my hope is that there will be some modification of what McConnell had anticipated and that Pelosi will turn over the articles of impeachment sooner rather than later.
Okay, that is WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge and senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, as we head towards the end of 2019, we are going to look back at the last decade in religion. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. 2019 is winding down, which means we're nearing the end of a decade. Between now and 2020, we're going to take some time here at Radio Boston to reflect on the past decade across a number of themes, from social movements to politics, pop culture. Today is the first of those, and today we want to look at the decade in religion. To help us do that, we're joined by three leaders in local religious communities. With me here in Studio 3 first is Thomas Groom, professor of theology and religious education at Boston College, past director of the Church in the 21st Century Center. He's also the author of Faith for the Heart, A Catholic Spirituality. Welcome back, Tom.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Also with us is Sheikh Yasir Fahmy, instructor on Muslim studies at Harvard Divinity School. Welcome back, Sheikh.
Thank you so much for having me.
And joining us is Rabbi Claudia Kramen, senior rabbi at the Temple Beth Zion in Brookline. I have just been a mess. Let's just do that one again. Rabbi Claudia Kramen, senior rabbi at Temple Beth Zion in Brookline.
Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome. Honest to God, we have done racial history, politics, and now religion. And so I think I am just feeling the weight of the subject.
And as you said, honest to God.
Oh, that's right. There you go. Listeners, we invite you to join this conversation to pull up at a chair at our table. How has the role of religion in America changed over the past 10 years from your perspective? What do you think the role should be? Are you, as an individual, more or less engaged with your faith tradition than you were 10 years ago? Are you someone who does not belong to a faith tradition, as a growing number of Americans are? Call us and share your thoughts with us. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'd love to hear from you. All right, so I think I'm going to ask the hardest question first. Tom, I'll come to you, but I'm going to ask all three of you this question, which is, if you were to pick a thematic through line for the tradition you represent over the past 10 years, so for you, Tom, Catholicism, what is that through line over the last 10 years?
Well, tragically, Tiziana, I suppose the one that we most identify readily is the dreadful sex abuse scandal. Now, I immediately add, yes, and we've also had Pope Francis, who has been a tremendous source of hope and a new moment in the history of our church in many ways. And yet the overriding challenge, disaster, tragedy, call it what you will, horrendous crimes, revolve around clergy sex abuse and then the negligence that allowed it to continue. So, but I suppose I want to say both and, because even as I identify that tragedy and scandal, I also say yes, but we have signs of hope, certainly with Pope Francis.
You know, and as we pursue this conversation, I guess I should say that in the previous decade, I actually had a formal role in the Archdiocese of Boston when I was the president of Catholic Charities. I reported up through to the cardinal. So I have a vested interest in one of these faith traditions, and I want to be clear about that. Sheikh, how about for you? Over the last 10 years, if there's a through line, what would you say?
I think probably most identifiable is that as a Muslim community, we're trying to transition from the first decade of the century, which was all about trying to explain to people what we are not, to now in this current decade, trying to proactively, through action and speech and teaching, explain to people what we are. Trying to be more identifiably Muslim in our orientation around our role in terms of questions of theology and spirituality and social welfare and wellness, political and civic engagement. A lot of what we did in the first decade was trying to tell people that we're not bad, because there was this very particular framing around the Muslim community, especially vis-a-vis what happened in light of 9/11, which was a tragic event that shook all of our collective lives. And so the Muslim community was in this position of trying to constantly explain and condemn and have these types of frames that they had to negotiate. Now you see the growth of a far more proactive orientation around teaching and education, social services, policies for institutes for policy research. You have, for example, the Yaqeen Seminary, Yaqeen Institute, which is very much committed to clarifying Islam, but also fortifying the identity of the Muslim. Initiatives like Celebrate Mercy, which are all about spreading the prophetic message of beauty and hope and mercy to all the world. Campaigns that were, you know, enacted for the Jewish community synagogue was attacked. So you had a campaign to raise over $200,000 for synagogues. You have initiatives like Iman in Chicago, which is all about the question of poverty and the disinvestment in the urban communities. And the list goes on of types of initiatives where we're transforming and being more proactive in reclaiming our narrative about what Islam and Muslims are.
And how about you, Rabbi Claudia? How would you frame the last decade for Judaism?
Yeah, I don't know if I can frame the last decade for all Judaism. That will take a long time. But I think that what is coming to mind, especially in the last several years and few years, is thinking about the rise of anti-Semitism in this country and in the world in general, and to think about how that is happening, of course, not in a vacuum, but it's happening in this country around so much racism, Islamophobia, and so many other hatreds that we are encountering. So I think that for the Jewish community here in America, this has been something new to encounter that we need to figure out and deal with. I come from South America, where actually for us wasn't new. So it's always interesting for me to realize that dealing with anti-Semitism and with hatred towards Jews in this country is something new that it's coming up for us. But again, I want to reiterate that it's clear that this is part of a trend that we are seeing around so much hatred and violence that is coming to many minorities in our country. And then in the plus side, I want to say, and this is as a congregational rabbi, and I've been a rabbi in my congregation for 12 years now, so it's more than a decade, really seeing how kind of a positive and wonderful side of thinking about how our religious life can be meaningful and intentional and have a voice in our secular life. That is, in many ways, the work that I'm trying to do, the commitment to social justice and to a moral voice that comes from religious life to everything that we do. It's at the center. So I see it in my congregation. I see it in the work of many of my colleagues, not only Jewish, but interfaith colleagues, where a lot of the work we are trying to do is to figure out how our faith can help us live a life that it's meaningful, help others. Remember that every human was created in the image of God.
Okay, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Ed's calling from the North Shore. Ed, what thoughts would you like to share?
Hey, good afternoon. How are you?
Well, thanks.
Well, it's a wonderful conversation. I'm delighted to have to be able to be a part of it and to hear all the different voices. I'm a trustee at the Maple Street Congregational Church in Danvers, Mass., up on the North Shore. And as a member of the UCC, one of our challenges, and all the challenge that is predominant among the UCC as a Protestant church, is to get the youth involved and to show the youth what the value is in the church and to give them not only a home but a support and a place to come to receive guidance, but also to find community and to find out about, you know, who they are as people and what the message is that we have for them. And I think this is true with all the faiths, whether it's the Muslim faith or the Jewish faith or whatever, you know, is to talk to the youth and to reach out and to use them as a touch point to get to the wider community and to share with them why religion is so important and
how it anchors our
country.
So, and, you know, it's an interesting Pew Research Center actually released some research that said that the percentage of adults who don't identify with any religious group has risen to 26% today from 17% in 2010. That's a big change. And, of course, that begins with our young people, with our children. I guess, well, Sheikh Yasser, let me just invite you first to reflect on what Ed said.
I think that certainly the question of the viability of religion in the life of the individual is a huge question that needs to be discussed and negotiated for all age groups, for that matter. I mean, the young people certainly. I mean, what we've seen in some of the research around Muslim youth is that they are invested in the question of Islam. But the question is, how are they invested? Because a lot of young people have grown up with a narrative around Islam that has been very politicized. It's been a part of a particular framing around the question of an identifiable group and how that's negotiated within the media and politically and otherwise. And so a lot of people, their Islam is as a function of that. And we're trying to now, and also the challenges of just the nature of our time, which is a very individualistic orientation. So a lot of people are taking their religion from just sitting behind a computer or listening to a lecture or, you know, just trying to explore their faith as an individual project rather than a communal project.
So I'm going to encourage several of you are sort of showing me that you want to talk. Just jump in. The more our listeners get a conversation between the three of you, the better.
Well, if I could take a turn to Sienna, to Ed's question, like, what do we do to attract and to retain our youth? And this may sound like a simplistic response, but I believe we have to appeal to their hearts. Now, in my own tradition, I often say for the first 1,000 years, Christianity basically appealed to people's hearts. And of course, St. Augustine was the epitome of that. Our hearts are restless until they rest in God. And the great monastic tradition of that first 1,000 years. The second 1,000 years, in large part, we appeal to people's reason. And, of course, Thomas Aquinas is the epitome of that. And then all of the doctrinal debates surrounding the Reformation, etc. But it was more of a head appeal to the dogmas and doctrines and to the provings of them. I think for this generation now, we have to go back to appealing to their hearts. Mm-hmm. Now, the dogmas and doctrines and scriptures will still have to be taught. But the starting point has to be people's hearts. I don't mean to have an easy plug here, but I just wrote a book called Faith for the Heart. And what I tried to do there is to say, we've got to begin with their hearts, engage their longing for freedom, their longing for justice, their longing to belong, to have meaning, to have purpose, to find love, to find happiness in life, that these are the great pains and hungers and desires of the heart that any one of our faiths can respond to richly. And in fact, there's no better way to respond than from a spiritual perspective. Sure. But it has to somehow begin there.
I love that about appealing to their heart. And I think that that is very much part of what we need to be doing. I'm very passionate about how we engage youth. Before, a part of my work at my temple has been always working with the young, and before that also, and really appealing to their heart and making sure that they understand that our religion is relevant. And I think that's part what is happening. That's the crisis, not just for young people, but we have to especially, how do we make sure that they understand that it's just relevant, that it is connected to their life, to their decisions, that it is important, that this is not some archaic rituals that their parents want them to do. And it is exciting for me to do that work with youth, with young people. I do it with our teenagers. I do it with our pre-teenagers, and really engaging with them in truth when they have a question, the way criticize, when they are not sure about answering, letting them say that and listening to them and bringing back what our tradition has to say. And when our tradition doesn't have something to say or has something to say that it's not really good or relevant or feels wrong for the kid, recognize it that.
Yeah. And I want to time out there because the three of you, of course, as faith leaders and as people who are devout in your traditions, have a good faith understanding of your own traditions and the things that it brings to families. I can imagine a listener saying, all three of these traditions, plus other Christian traditions, are also heavily associated now with nationalism, heavily associated with politics, heavily associated with restraints and placing constraints. I'm going to cheat, and I'm going to bring in a quote from Pastor Scott Lively, who is a Christian pastor, former multiple-time candidate for governor. When he spoke with WBUR's Anthony Brooks on Radio Boston about his activism in international anti-gay efforts.
Right. Homosexuality is evil, according to God. It's called an abomination in the Bible. And any movement that's attempting to legitimize sexual perversion is an evil movement.
Well, as you know,
that's just basic historic Christian perspective.
So to those who would say that in the last 10 years, various faith traditions have also been deeply engaged in othering, in separating out or engaging, especially in America, in potentially removing rights. And I want to say as I finish this question that I also recognize that much of the violence that our faith traditions, our synagogues, our mosques have experienced are the result of other people engaging in othering. Let's grapple with that.
So,
go ahead.
So one thing to think about is like the same way that religion can be the reason for so much hatred, religion can be what the solution for that. And that, I think, is what we would all agree that are here sitting, that that's what we need to do. And this is what I started saying. I can't talk for all Judaism, for all Jews. We can't talk about all faith leaders. And clearly to say to those kind of voices that will say what it said about LGBTQ or about any other things that the Bible says or that tradition says, that one of the ways that I am dealing with this is to realize and recognize that we have to read texts a little different to understand and how our traditions have evolved. In Judaism especially, we understand this notion of rabbinic Judaism, which is a tradition that evolves with the times. It is also connected to women's and women's gender. I couldn't be here, sitting here as a rabbi, if we would be reading the Bible literally. So we understand that our times ask for our tradition to read and understand our texts differently, and that our traditions, my traditions have a moral voice to all this, and that's what we're trying to do.
Let's bring in the other two. The,
well, I love what Rabbi Claudia just said, that it always, our faith always has to be contextualized in the culture, the situation, which will cause it at times to push back against the culture, to critique the culture, but it has to, it can't be above the culture. I always think the best example of that is Jesus himself, that six at least, maybe seven times in the Gospels, he's reported to have violated the Sabbath. And it was to feed hungry people or to cure sick people. And he, Jesus was not doing away with the Sabbath. He was totally in favor of the Sabbath. He kept the Sabbath. In Luke 4, when it says he went in on the Sabbath day to his home synagogue in Nazareth, of which he was accustomed. So he was loyal to the Sabbath. And yet when he met a sick person or a hungry person, he dispensed with Sabbath in order to cure that person. In other words, he contextualized his faith. And as we go forward through the centuries, it's the same thing. The thing on LGBTQ, for example, I mean, my own church very often sins egregiously in that regard, but basically it's operating on a false biology, a false medical that taught that this was a perversion, that this is just a choice, that people are being aberrations or something to nature when they do this. This is how 1/10 or whatever it is, 8% of people, or how God makes 8 or 10% of our people. So not to welcome and include them in our faith communities, that's the sin. Not the other way around.
I think one of the challenges that we're facing today in our social sphere, which is everything has become a simple, blunt binary of good or evil. And when we're trying to force everything into the frame of it's either purely good or purely evil, we end up losing a lot of the gray and the nuance, which actually animates the reality of the world that we live in. It's not a simple world. This world is complex. We are complex beings. We are comprised of body, soul, spirit. We have deep theologies and beliefs which are in the mind, intellectual. We have these hearts and these souls which are the apparatus of how we feel and how we operate. We have these bodies which desire and yearn. And then we have this context which the professor indicated, which is a complex context. I mean, we live in a very unique world, especially with the technological evolution and growth and the reality of the internet. So what I would personally advocate for all of us who are seekers and we're searching and we're trying to understand, is that we try to deconstruct a little bit of the forced framing of you're either with me or against me. And that we have to start appreciating the complexity of all of these realities that we're facing, right? Your lead about the question that a lot has been attributed to religion. Certainly, yes, I see that the coverage around very specific things in the media is around how this particular religion may be oriented around that. But if we look at a lot of the studies, a lot of the detailed analytics, or whether done by Pew or Gallup or even by the FBI, you'll see that statistics show a different reality. There is a scourge of fascism. There is a certain type of supremacism that exists that does not discriminate against any faith tradition or everyone. There are people in this world who just believe that it's either us or no one. It's either us and everyone else has to be eliminated. That's a toxic philosophical orientation that we see as underpinning in unfortunately, a good percentage of circles.
Let's add a couple of caller voices to this. 1-800-423-8255. Let's do two. Stan is calling from Quincy. Go ahead, Stan.
Hi, thanks. I wanted to make a comment based mainly on what you, Tishira, brought up at the very beginning when you asked what would be one of the major evolutions in religion recently.
Yeah.
Sorry? Yeah. And also, you brought it up again a little bit with this quote from Scott Lively, so it ties in there as well. And that is just this. I'm a Protestant, and one of the things that has been torturing us in the last, longer than the last decade, but especially in the last 2-3 years, is the strong adherence, almost worshipful adherence, that evangelical Christianity has had for right-wing politics. It's inexplicable to me, and I don't quite understand where it came from. And especially in the last 2 or 3 years, the way that they have really gotten an almost worshipful attitude towards Donald Trump, who is not particularly religious at all.
Thank you for raising that, Stan. And I'm going to take two calls here, but I'm going to make sure that we talk about the politicization of religion. I'd also like to pick up Jeffrey, who's calling from the South End. Jeffrey, what's on your mind?
Yeah, full disclosure, first of all, I'm a member of Rob Claudia's congregation.
Oh, all right. Thanks for disclosing.
Hi, Jeff.
That's number one. But number two, I want to talk about the beauty of the interfaith work that's going on in the religious world. And I'll give you one example. After the Pittsburgh shooting, where a number of Jews were killed, I was in New York, and I happened to be attending the largest LGBTQ congregation in Midtown Manhattan. And they had, since September 11, 2001, on a weekly basis, gone down to NYU to stand outside the mosque and to talk to Muslims and tell them that we're all brothers and sisters. That night that I was in Manhattan, just after the Pittsburgh shooting, I got to the synagogue, and there was a long line of Muslims outside saying, "You Jews are our brothers and sisters." Mm. There's a lot of that going on. Ralph Claudia does a lot of that kind of work. And I just want to say that amidst all the doom and gloom, and there's certainly a lot of it, there's a lot of hope. There's a lot of good people out there doing a lot of good things.
That's a great call, Jeff. I'm going to take it back from you there. I appreciate you raising it. So we have two ends of a continuum there. On one end, a very observable politicization of religion in the United States and arguably globally that goes around certain types of conservative and progressive identities, nationalist identities, et cetera. And on the other hand, a praising of real attempts at interfaith encounter. How do we make sense that of both of those things being things that we could be talking about so completely at the same time in the last decade?
Well, I think the question and your own comment, Tiziana, makes the point that, and this is a summary statement, that this is why we have to take religion so seriously in today's world. I mean, the three of it, I'm singing for the choir in this context here. But I mean, there's nothing more life-giving than good religion. But there's nothing more dangerous than bad religion. Mm. And there's lots of both around. And I mean, this type of fundamentalist readings of the text can drive you to anything. You can prove anything. Shakespeare said it well. Even the devil can cite scripture to the devil's advantage. And so you can prove almost anything you want to prove. So that it's a tragic that so many good Christian people think that their faith is demanding that, for example, they vote for Donald Trump. I mean, that is a total false consciousness and a misunderstanding of Christian faith. And yet it happened the last election. It could happen the next election. So, but that type of the power of it has to be taken very seriously, not just religiously, but spiritually and socially.
So I'm simply going to channel the listener who's not going to have a chance to call in and say, it doesn't make me a bad Christian to vote for Donald Trump.
No, it doesn't make a bad Christian at all. But if they're voting for Donald Trump out of Christian conviction, and warranted by their reading of the Bible, then I would say they're being misled.
Okay, so we've got about 2 minutes left. I'm going to go to each of you.
I just want to share on that we have to beware of the politicization of our religions and our religious discourse. You know, not everything is about the stark political question. It's certainly critical that we negotiate politics and civic engagement, but the richness of our traditions, our spiritual traditions that the professor spoke about in terms of the heart, and the spirit. These are essential questions. When you look at the rise of loneliness, anxiety, depression, people feeling dejected, I mean, these are serious challenges, concerns that many in our public sphere are suffering from. You know, I want us to collectively reclaim our traditions to identify and show where our traditions speak over the past, not just, you know, for us 1,400 years, but for others thousands, you know, what we have to say in this particular regard. And with that, we have to unite and come together in solidarity to be a united force, regardless of what our backgrounds are, against these very, I would call, demonic impulses that we see in so many circles today.
Last minute,
yeah,
to Rabbi
thank
Claudia.
You, and thank you, Jeffrey, for calling. And I want to say that this interfaith work is so important. I just came right now from my monthly Brooklyn interfaith meetings that we have every month, and being able to be in this work with interfaith colleagues, meeting monthly, having relationship. I was at the mosque at ASBCC after the attack in New Zealand, and Muslim friends and Protestant friends and Catholic friends came to TBZ, to our temple after Pittsburgh. It's really a recognition that we take religion seriously and we believe the religion has a moral value. It is very hard with these current administrators to think about this, because when we see the things that are happening around immigration, about racism, about homophobia, about so many things, that our tradition will say, you cannot treat human beings this way, then we have to ask, what has what we have to say for this, and that's the work.
Okay, that is Rabbi Claudia Kramen, Senior Rabbi at Temple Beth Zion in Brookline. Thank you.
Thank you.
Also with us, Sheikh Yasir Fahmy, Instructor of Muslim Studies at Harvard Divinity School. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Thomas Groom, Professor of Theology and Religious Education at Boston College. Thanks so much.
You're welcome, Tiziana. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
That's our show for today. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.